BNR Nieuwsradio. The Big Five. Diana Matroos.
Welkom bij BNR's Big Five van de Nieuwe Macht. En daarbij vallen woorden als een nieuwe bestuurscultuur, nieuw leiderschap. Het is duidelijk dat we een weg zoeken hoe we na de coronacrisis ons land en de wereld vanuit politiek opzicht, maar natuurlijk ook vanuit het bedrijfsleven en de samenleving opnieuw vormgeven. En ik wil heel graag weten, waar staan we? Is deze coronatijd een wake-up call? Of zijn we dat allang weer vergeten? En hoe doorbreek je weerstand? Deze week praat ik daarover met 4 prominente Nederlanders, 4 visionairs. En vandaag is dat niemand minder dan Paul Polman. Als topman van Unilever maakte hij zich al hard voor duurzaamheid en voor een meer maatschappelijke rol voor het bedrijfsleven. En nu helpt hij met zijn organisatie Imagine andere bedrijven in de wereld. En hij geeft in Nederland eigenlijk nauwelijks interviews, maar vandaag wel een uur lang. Mr. Paul Polman, welcome to the show. So great that you could join me today. And maybe our listeners are wondering, because you're Dutch from origin, but we do this interview in English. Why?
Well, I just flew in from the US. I left the Netherlands in 77. And a long time ago, I made a decision to just do all the interviews in English and
it's easier.
Save myself the time a little bit, to be honest.
Okay, that's great.
So, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all. But I was wondering, do you still feel a connection with the Netherlands?
Well, it is difficult to this audience. You have to be polite, but it's always a pleasure to visit the country, and it's always good to go back to your home as well.
Yeah.
So that's how I look at it. But yeah, obviously you're born here, so.
And it was also your lottery
always,
for success.
My father always reminded us, vergeet je huisnummer nooit. So that's very important. I came from Twente, so we keep both feet on the ground and we stay what you call nuchter. So that's very important to us. And I think there are a lot of good Dutch qualities that I take with me. And when I get here, I like my bitterballen and my drop and my stroopwafels. So those things don't disappear.
Gelukkig. Jammer, heb ik geen stroopwafels vandaag mee.
No, that's okay.
Of course, you have a large network of top leaders in politics and business worldwide. Who inspires you the most?
Well, you know, that's it's a good question, because most people would expect answers like Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela or Mother Teresa and all these people, and they are great leaders. But actually, I get my inspiration from other people. That having done the job in Unilever as CEO for the last 10 years and having been in all the countries in the world, it's the people actually in the local communities, especially the women, who make the things work. You know, like the doctors who went to West Africa when there was Ebola, with the risk of their own lives, or the healthcare workers now with COVID, not knowing what the disease was all about in the beginning. The people on the ground who work with the blind and deaf blind, where I have a foundation in Africa, often for a pittance of compensation, but dedicating themselves 24 hours to others. So the real leaders for me are people who put themselves to the service of others, knowing that by doing so, they're better off themselves as well.
And that's very interesting, because this week is about new leadership. But first, let's talk about the remarkable moment we live in these days due to Corona, but also other things. What kind of crisis are we in? What kind of transition? What do you think?
Well, this is a serious crisis, but it should not have been a surprise. COVID is not really something that we could not have seen coming. We had SARS, Ebola, Zika, Asian flu. So now we have a particularly nasty one, but this is one of many still to come. And it really, most of these diseases are zoonotic diseases, which means that they actually stem from the destruction of nature. We've lived as if we could have infinite growth on a finite planet, and anything, obviously, you can do infinitely, which we've discovered now, is by definition unsustainable. So this growth is crisis is certainly a wake up call. I think what we've seen in 2020 was the pause that we had, at least among certain people who were not victimized by COVID. There are many people that went back into poverty, about 150 million back into extreme poverty, or 500 million job equivalents have been lost in a world population where already many people are suffering. So they have other problems. They worry about food for today, jobs for tomorrow. But the people like us who are in a fortunate position have had a pause and reflection. And what I think people have realized is that you can't have healthy people on an unhealthy planet. And people are increasingly understanding something that was difficult for us to convey, but that is the complex interdependence between biodiversity, human health, climate change, inequality, the racial dimensions with the tragic death of George Floyd in the US. So people are now understanding how it all links. Yeah. And hopefully...
And you already addressed that 2020 was a wake-up call for everyone, now it's 2021. And the first there was fear and also optimism about changing the world. But now everyone is thinking, well, I get my vaccine and we get back to normal.
There is a risk like that, but I'm a stubborn optimist because people have understood actually, unlike the financial crisis 10, 12 years ago, when we went back to normal, that inequality kept going up, climate change was not being addressed. I think there's now a higher level of awareness that we need to do something. Where at that time, about 12 years ago at the financial crisis, we saw when the world was spending a lot of money to save the banks, people felt that banks were too big to fail, but people were too small to matter. And only about 5% of the spending was going to right-sizing the global economy. Now it's quite different. People have seen the enormous cost, the tragic loss of human lives, obviously the most important ones, but people have seen enormous cost in COVID. In fact, the global economy has lost over $22 trillion. Mm-hmm. Combined in Europe and the US, we've spent $16 trillion just to stabilize, to save lives and livelihoods. So I think people have realized that this is too high a price to pay. And what you now see is an acceleration of action that is quite different from 10, 12 years ago. It's not enough, but the direction is clear. We're not debating anymore the why, but it's now the how and how fast. And this is where we need
also
to focus.
Also, there's a lot of anger in society and people are very angry also about, when I look here in the Netherlands, but I think it's a global problem that when we want to solve the climate crisis, a lot of people say, oh, it's all fake news. So we're still debating also.
Well, some are, but I wouldn't spend too much time on that. And in due respect to the people who want to debate that, but it's basically too late. I think the science is overwhelming. The governments have moved. We now have all the G7 countries making the commitment to be net zero by 2050, which means stay below the 1.5 degrees. There is overwhelming evidence out there that that can be achieved at a cost that is lower to society than if we would not do anything. We've seen that just now with COVID, just a small sample of that. And I think most people are moving. What you saw in 2020, interestingly, was that companies that were run under the multi-stakeholder, longer-term model, putting purpose at its core, ESG as a key driver, were actually performing better. You saw the same in the financial market.
Examples?
Examples would be companies like Microsoft, companies like Unilever, companies like Nike, companies like Salesforce, and I can mention a whole battery of them. In fact, Just Capital, which is an organization in the US, looked at the 1,000 companies that are in the Russell, and companies that were purpose-driven, sustainability at its core, had a 30% higher return over the last 4 years. Another example is very simply the ESG funds. So many more people now, especially the younger generations, want to put their money in a more purpose-driven fund that makes this a better world, not a worse world. They've understood what is happening, especially that generation. The ESG funds have seen the biggest inflow of funds during 2020, despite the pandemic. And actually, the performance has been quite remarkable. 80% of these funds have outperformed their benchmarks.
So you really see a change. But on the other hand, we have an economic crisis. The governments have to see also a lot of problems regarding this problem, but also the businesses.
Correct.
So isn't this really a setback for sustainability?
Oh, no, it's not a setback for sustainability at all, because we've actually seen, as we just talked, an acceleration on sustainability. It's a setback for the sustainable development agenda. We've actually seen that women disproportionately, again, lost the jobs. People that were vulnerable already and didn't have a social safety net have paid, again, a higher price for it. The racial dimension that has come in, twice as likely to die from COVID in the US amongst people of color versus Caucasians. So I think it has pushed us back undoubtedly 10 to 20 years on the sustainable development agenda. But what we're now seeing is that people are realizing that it's all related, that we cannot have a good inclusive, sustainable economic growth if we go back to where we came from.
So if you would give a name for 2020, this is a wake-up call. If you would give a name to 2021, what would you say?
I would say stubborn optimism. Outrage on the one hand that we're not moving fast enough. Optimism that we are starting to realize this and are moving in the right direction. We have the European Green Deal, which is a very encouraging move, the European taxonomy, the farm to fork, the circular economy package. Europe is moving. We see the same now with Biden in the US. The administration is moving. There's more cooperation again at multilateral levels. Even countries like China on the issue of climate change are sitting around the table. So there are signs that should give us courage. Technology obviously has accelerated and made a lot more things possible. People are speaking out. Every country, every company, every school has a Greta Thunberg now. Mm-hmm. So I think there are a lot of elements that we can harness. And now we need to work together differently and design something better than where we came from.
Okay, great.
The Big Five. The Big Five. Diana Matroos.
Deze week praat ik in BNR's Big Five van de Nieuwe Macht met prominente Nederlanders over het zoeken naar een nieuwe macht en hoe we daarbij weerstanden doorbreken. Eerder deze week sprak ik daarover met Herman Cenk Willink, Herna Verhagen, CEO van PostNL, en met de Nationale Ombudsman. Alle gesprekken zijn terug te luisteren via onze app. Mijn gast vandaag is Paul Polman, de voormalig topman van Unilever en medeoprichter van Imagine, waarmee hij bedrijven over de wereld helpt met grote duurzame transities. En mijn gasten stellen elkaar vragen via de kettingvraag. Gisteren sprak ik met Herman Cenk Willink, informateur, een voormalig vicepresident van de Raad van State, ook wel de onderkoning van Nederland genoemd. En hij had deze vraag.
Nog los van de newspeak, nieuw leiderschap over veranderingen gaat. En verandering betekent ook altijd doorbreken van bestaande machtsverhoudingen. En soms lukt dat, en vaak lukt dat niet. En wat zijn naar uw eigen ervaringen de voornaamste voorwaarden waaronder dat lukt? En welke rol kan het nieuwe leiderschap daarin spelen? Dat zou mijn vraag aan Paul Polman zijn, ook gelet op zijn ervaringen als CEO van Unilever.
So, loosely translated, Herman Cenk Willink is stating new leadership is about changes, and change always means breaking through current power structures. Sometimes it works, often it doesn't. And his question to you, Mr. Polman, is what main conditions make change work, and what role plays new leadership?
It's a very good question, and Herman is right. Most of the change efforts actually fail, and because they're ill-conceived and they're done in a vacuum. And what you find is many factors push back. In business, people are more playing not to lose than playing to win. In politics, it's becoming increasingly short-term. The cooperation to have these partnerships to get the real breakthroughs of what is needed are missing. The vested order is pushing back. If you're in the fossil fuel industry, you don't want to really work aggressively on tackling climate change. So all these factors make change difficult. What are the conditions to drive change? I think, first of all, it's individuals who drive change, so it's the moral leadership. People with a stronger sense of purpose, who know what is needed in society and put themselves to the service of that, they can handle the little bumps that come along the way, the cynics, the skeptics. Mm-hmm. I had that in Unilever when we started our sustainable living plan 12 years ago. The world wasn't ready for it. The financial market didn't quite understand it. There were a lot of people pushing back. Only when the results came in and people started to see the benefits of running a model like that, did we win over people. But it was our strong sense of purpose that we were here to serve society, mm-hmm, and not our shareholders that kept us going. The other condition is trust. You cannot get partnerships and work together with people, which is absolutely needed now, if you don't have a level of trust. That comes from transparency, that comes from taking responsibility, that comes from having accountability. And finally, I've mentioned it twice, we need to work in a different level. Someone very wise once said, you can't solve the problems at the level that these problems were created. So we have to work in different forms of partnership actually for the common good, mm-hmm, where businesses work together with civil society and governments to address some of the major system changes. the challenge between man and nature, the short and long term, the few and the many. You know, how do you make it more of an inclusive?
And earlier you stated there are two big issues: a chronic lack of leaders and a chronic lack of trees.
Yes,
so we are short of. This is our problem at the moment.
Oh, absolutely, we are short of courageous leaders in this world, and we are short of trees. I mean, we've cut half the world's forests, and that's giving us climate change, quote unquote. And by the way, it's also the best and easiest solution. Technology that has been invented that is called a tree is probably the best invention that we have on this planet Earth, and we need to cherish it. But as long as we value a tree that is dead more than a tree that is alive, we are in trouble. Mm-hmm. And then the leadership, you know, we've become very self-centered. We've become a me society, and we have a we problem. And a we problem can only be solved in a we society. So we need leaders with a stronger moral compass, more purpose-driven, thinking intergenerational, systemic thinkers, being able to work in partnerships with other people. And frankly, our educational programs have not given them. The MBA programs or the business programs are basically Milton Friedman on steroid copies. And it's all about profit, it's all about win-lose, and market share, and you know, you're good, I'm bad, and that just doesn't work anymore. You cannot compete on the future of humanity. We need to make more things pre-competitive. We need to forge different forms of partnership, and we need to look at different returns than only financial return, to also do environmental and social returns.
But this is very crucial, what you're stating now. And earlier, I also spoke about this with Feike Siebesma, about Milton Friedman. There is where it went wrong, and also business education is centered around it. But how can we change our education system? Because it's all focused on Milton Friedman.
Well, I'm the chairman of the Site Business School, and I chair the UN Global Compact for the Secretary General. And we have there a organization called Principles for Responsible Management Education. And that's about 700 of the biggest and best universities in the world. And I can tell you that this is the main debate that we have in every shareholder meeting. And students are asking for that. So obviously there is a component of making higher education more gender diverse, bringing in the racial dimension, the addressing the issues of inequality. It's very elitist in most countries of the world, the digital component. But we also have to combine the business studies with the social sciences and leverage the broader education that is given to us to address some of these issues. So, yeah, it does require making that the core of education, putting sustainability or ethics, not as a special course you can sign up for if you feel like it, mm-hmm. but putting it in every program. You cannot teach people artificial intelligence, for example, if you don't have ethics in the middle of that course. And as a core, it just doesn't work. And I think the better universities like the Site Business School in Oxford and the INSEADs, the ESAs in Spain, they're starting to understand that, and they see their business actually growing. They're doing very well.
So you have a lot of discussions about this, but things there also changing?
Well, academic institutions are notoriously slow to change, and there are other dynamics than business. But if they don't change, they'll become dinosaurs. That market is moving very fast, especially now also with the digital dimension. So, you know, you want to be part of it. And if you want to be part of it and be around in the future, I don't think you have a choice but to change.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to new leadership, it's also very important to involve youth. You once stated, don't give them a seat at a table, give them the table.
Absolutely, absolutely. Half the world population is below 30 years old, and they're going to be 100% tomorrow, if we like it or not. They're creative, they're innovative, they're more purpose-driven, they know technology. Frankly, they work in better levels of partnership. They think a little bit longer term than us. And anytime we involve youth, I'm involved in several of the youth networks globally, but anytime, not only do I get selfishly energized, but it is very clear to me that they are ready to take the baton. They don't see this as failures of all of us, that all these issues have crept up on us, and that we should be grateful for that. But they see it as enormous opportunities to address with a sense of optimism and positiveness. And that is what we need, with a sense of realism. But that is what we need. Yeah. So yeah, young people have to be part of deciding their future.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So give them the table. That's your statement. But we see a lot of difficulties to make that change. So when you talk with business leaders, what do they tell you?
Well, you take, for example, even when I left Unilever, half of the workforce in Unilever was already millennial generation or Generation Z. So we turn the organization upside down. We create forums. We give them opportunities to lead some of the projects and be in the boardroom, so to speak. So organizations that don't cater, by the way, to the younger population, don't run their businesses in a responsible way, don't put purpose in the middle, don't address these planetary boundary issues, they will have a hard time attracting talent. You know, in the world globally, it's always been a sad statistic that has never changed during my lifetime, but only 15% of the people are engaged at work. And I feel sad each time I say that. That means 85% of us, to be ourselves, to develop ourselves to the fullest potential, is lost when we go to work. So can we not wake up to that and understand that if we can create the environments where everybody can be their own, where we address these issues that people care about, also when they go home and in their lives, we would be so much better. You know, in Unilever, we saw the engagement scores go from the middle to the top tercile. We became the number three most desired employer in the world just by putting a more responsible business model out there. That alone should be worth it. And the good thing is now shareholders can measure it. They can actually measure the value of employee brand attractiveness, employee engagement, culture. So these become very important drivers of business success.
Yeah, we will talk a lot more about the shareholders and also the problems that we're facing at that point. But one question before we go to the break. Which leader sets a good example right now?
Oh, I think you need to go to, I don't want to single out any individual, not for just political reasons, but I think we all have elements of it, but not holistically. And we all need each other to become stronger for what is needed. This is an enormous change that is required in society. It was an enormous risk and exposure to the people going to lead that. And we should obviously encourage and nurture them. But this has to be a combined effort. And fortunately, I think we're seeing a whole new generation of CEOs when you talk about the private sector coming in, but also in business. We see more women coming in business. Interestingly, the countries that have done best during COVID, the Icelands, the Norways, the Denmarks, the Finlands, the New Zealands, were all run by women. So we should cherish those leaders and nurture them. There's no question about it.
Okay, let's talk some more after the break. Mijn gast in BNR's Big Five van de Nieuwe Macht is Paul Polman. En ik wil zo meteen weten hoe hij aankijkt tegen de macht van aandeelhouders in het post-COVID-tijdperk. Tot zo.
BNR Nieuwsradio. The Big Five. Diana Matroos.
Welkom bij het tweede halfuur van BNR's Big Five van de Nieuwe Macht. Deze week spreek ik met vier prominente Nederlanders die met mij kijken naar hoe we Nederland en de wereld na corona opnieuw willen vormgeven. Wat voor soort leiders hebben we nodig om verder te komen? En welke weerstanden moeten we op welke manier doorbreken? Mijn gast vandaag is Paul Polman, de voormalig topman van Unilever en medeoprichter van Imagine. We doen dit interview in het Engels omdat Polman, dat na 40 jaar wonen en werken in het buitenland, het prettigste vindt, dat heeft hij ook al even in het eerste deel uitgelegd. So, Mr. Polman, also on a personal level, you wanted to be a priest when you were young, but you ended up as a businessman. What happened?
Serendipity and basically my father saying that it was time I earned my own living. But, I wanted to be a priest and I wanted to be a doctor. I was two times uitgeloot. So I had to do something else. So you do law or economics at that time. I was in Groningen at university. I wasn't really motivated. That wasn't really what I wanted. But I had to do something and study. And then I decided to go to the U.S., learn English and change a little bit. I wasn't very impressed with really the studies at that time. And my father had arranged to work in a company in the U.S. So that's why I ended up there. I went to school there, did my MBA and my MA in economics, my MBA in finance, met my wife there, which was basically the reason I stayed at the university. And then I ended up in business. So a life of serendipity. I've always believed you create opportunities and then you pick the one that is most attractive and you don't look back. But even if I would start today, after I left Unilever, I've obviously thought, what should I do? And, I'd still, if I had a little bit longer life ahead of me, I would still, try to become a doctor again, probably. Or
a priest.
Or a priest. I wouldn't, I don't know. There are some limitations in the Catholic Church that were not too attractive to me. But, what it basically is is helping others. And that was very much how I grew up. I was born in 1956. My parents' education was taken away from them because of the war. My father was 15 when the war started, goodbye high school. And he's worked his whole life in two jobs just to be sure that his kids would go to school and get education, that the communities functioned, that there was peace in Europe. They truly put themselves to the service of others. And I think that's how we grew up.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I've been attracted to professions that offer that. And the more I went into business, the more I discovered that, you know, business could be an incredible force for good and could be that galvanizer of change.
So you used Unilever to do good for the world?
Well, I've always said
mission.
To people, I've yeah. always said to people, you know, my sentences have often taken out of context, but I've said, you know, the reason I stayed 10 years was the first 5 years I had to put the company in good shape, and we had very good people that that did a lot of the work there and the heavy lifting, and fortunately that worked. But the last 5 years I stayed because I thought that the size and scale of a company like that in 190 countries reaching 3 billion consumers a day is more than any government can do. That's an enormous force for good.
Yeah.
And so using that transformative change is a responsibility, not is an obligation, to be honest.
But how frustrating was it also when it comes to shareholders? Because when you decided to focus on long-term goals at Unilever and stopped reporting quarterly, stocks went down and there were also troubles with the shareholders. So how frustrating was that?
You know, the newspapers always like to pick up on the shareholders that make noise, but really don't have the capability to see what percent of the shareholders that is. So the impression that is being given out there is often different mm-hmm. than the reality. We saw the same when we tried unification in the Netherlands. Newspapers are driven by sensation and winners and losers, but often lose that reality of it. The fact is that most of the funds that is being invested by the financial community are pension funds. These are institutional investors.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't only want a good return 20 years from now, 30 years from now, which companies like Unilever give, but they also want to be sure that you can retire in these in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't serve to give someone a pension in a world you can't live in.
Yeah, okay. So, I understand, and the media, they take the small pieces out. Understand that. But when recently we saw how the CEO of Danone, Emmanuel Faber, was forced out by shareholders, only 3% of the shareholders.
It's not true. If I may, Diana, if I may interrupt you there, and I don't want to correct you there, but he was not forced out by shareholders. It was his board who didn't support him. So I can give you 1,000 examples of companies that are run short-term for the shareholders, the Boeings, the Wells Fargos, the GEs in the Netherlands, the KPNs, and many more that are run short-term for quarterly profits that have come bankrupt. In the US, 20 years ago, there were 6,400 publicly traded companies. Now there are 3,500. Most of them have gone to the graveyard of dinosaurs because they run it short-term. So even if you run it sustainably, you need to get the right people, you need to get the right categories you're in, you need to have the right strategy. That's a given.
Mm-hmm.
But it is now overwhelmingly proven that companies that take climate change into account are more gender balanced, have better human rights standards in their value chain, they have a higher chance of getting better results. That doesn't mean all those companies do. In Danone's case, they were in categories that they were not building share, their share price had not moved for 10 years, they were losing market share, the board got dysfunctionally impatient.
Mm-hmm.
So the CEO, who is a very good guy and has done a lot of good things, was replaced. And actually now Antoine de Saint-Affrique, who's there, is an ex-Unilever person. He used to work for me in the management team.
Yeah.
It's a very good choice. But that happens. The biggest challenge I had with Unilever to ensure that we got results. We got 300% shareholder return over 10 years. We were outgrowing our competitive set.
Yeah.
So the reason that our share went down when I stopped quarterly reporting was that I did that when I came, because I figured they can't fire me the day they hire me.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped immediately giving guidance and quarterly reporting. So a certain part of the financial community dumped the shares because they thought bad news is coming. Usually when a new CEO comes in, and by the way, the share price had gone up 8% when I was announced. So it went down 8% with this.
Mm-hmm.
It shows you also the nonsense that is going on in the financial market.
Yeah.
But since then, we've steadily built our share and outgrown the market.
Okay,
by
but maybe
big factor.
You can explain this to me, because at your website I saw this statement: more CEOs would work on change if they had the time, the tools, and the safe space.
Yes, absolutely. So they need the three, because there is no doubt that there is, with the amount of money that is being pumped in the global economy, which is 4, 5, 6 times more than the money that is needed to run the economy, is all chasing returns.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an element of short-termism that has crept in the financial markets, even more so now than 10 years ago. And some of these boards are reacting to that. Some of the asset managers are still rewarding their people on short-term performance.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really see a human behind the company. They see a number. And that number needs to go up every quarter because it's linked to their rewards. So there is dysfunctional behavior without any doubt in the financial market that needs to change.
And how frustrating was that for you when you were CEO?
You can make it frustrating, but that's not a good thing to do. Because if you make it frustrating, it affects you. That's mm-hmm. what frustration does.
Yeah.
So, and then and it controls you.
I understand.
So you don't want to.
Yeah.
So you want to control you. So you want to do what you want to think about it and say, what can I do to change that? Because these are the real systems changes that we need to move the financial market to the longer term. So we created something at a global level with all major asset owners, asset managers, companies like ours, which we call focusing capital on the long term. So I've been one of the founders. I've been on the board 10 years. Now Cheryl Dean from DSM is on the board. I just got off when I stepped down from Unilever. But that has resulted in, for example, bringing higher awareness to people like Larry Fink from BlackRock. They have $7-8 trillion of money under management. He writes now his famous letters that purpose is important, that you need to go long term. Now they're starting to be voicing their concerns more to companies that don't move on climate change, and because they've seen the risks, they've seen the opportunities. So I think slowly but surely we will change the financial markets. We've seen the growth of the B Corps and other mm-hmm. corporate entreprises à mission in France, like Danone, that provide you a broader legal protection than only the shareholders. We've seen the European laws coming in on taxonomy and...
Okay, so
and
you see
so there is
change.
Movement. There is movement.
There's movement, but what happened at Danone, this didn't make you sad when it comes to the position of a CEO?
It makes me sad because it's not a nice way to go, and he's a great guy, but unfortunately, you cannot correlate ESG with, hey, it doesn't work because the CEO is out. What I'm saying now is there are far more companies that are not functioning because they might optically, we're focusing on short-term shareholder return.
Mm-hmm.
But there will undoubtedly be some companies that run under the banner of ESG that might not perform because they are making the wrong acquisitions or they, you know, yeah. There's still other things that you need to do. But overwhelmingly, we see now that that is the preferred way of running your business. That is really what we're talking.
And we talked about change and new leadership. When it comes to new leaders, they must have a lot of courage, I think.
Well, courage only comes from a stronger inner core, and courage is actually from the French word cœur, which means heart. And so it means having as much a heart as a brain. And that is absolutely needed. The leaders of today and tomorrow, I would argue, have to operate with a much higher level of empathy, compassion, humility, humanity. And these are things that are not taught to the dominant male A-type personalities that still run many of these businesses. So we need to nurture these things. And that is what courage does. Courage is not just making a decision without thinking about it and jumping off a high tower because it looks, stoer in Dutch.
Yeah.
No, courage is thinking with the heart and the head to thoughtfully transform these businesses and make them what I call net positive. I'm about to publish a book after the summer, which I call net positive. Right now, most companies are in the CSR space, corporate social responsibility, which really deals with less bad, really deals with risk management. And in a world where we already have overshot the planetary boundaries, that's just not good enough anymore. So companies that want to be around long-term need to show that they're actually making this a better world. Otherwise, why would we keep them around? And that's what net positive is all about.
Zometeen praat ik verder met Paul Polman, maar eerst even horen wat het topic straks is in BNR Breekt om 11 uur.
Ja, Diana, we gaan heel eventjes weer naar het Nederlands. Van topic naar het breekijzer. Want gezond eten is in 10 jaar tijd duurder geworden dan ongezond eten, meldt het CBS vandaag. Daarom ons breekijzer. Een suikertax is de enige manier om mensen gezonder te laten eten. Wat denk jij? Eens of oneens? Vanaf 11 uur mag je meepraten. 020-468-4x0. 020-468-4x0. Spreek ik je in BNR Breekt.
BNR Nieuwsradio. The Big Five. Diana Matroos.
Je luistert naar BNR's Big Five van de Nieuwe Macht. Mijn gast is Paul Polman, oud-topman van Unilever en mede-oprichter van Imagine. Mijn gasten stellen elkaar vragen via de kettingvraag. En volgende week is er uiteraard weer een nieuwe week van dit programma. Dat maakt mijn collega Art Rooijakkers een week met de hoofdredacteuren van verschillende nieuwsorganisaties. En zijn eerste gast die week is Harm Taselaar. Hij is de hoofdredacteur van RTL Nieuws. Overigens mijn baas geweest een heel aantal jaar. Dus ik vind het superleuk dat Harm Taselaar ook hier bij de Big Five is. And as you know, Mr. Polman, you may leave a question for our next guest. So the editor-in-chief from RTL News.
Well, I have a question for Harm. And it basically is there is a general belief out there that the media has become more polarized and actually driving us more apart versus driving us together at a time that we need more cooperation. So my question to him is really how he sees the role of media in driving the broader institutional changes that are needed, the ones that we're talking, especially when you're operating in such a politically charged environment.
Okay, he will address that question, my colleague, to Harm Taselaar, but what do you think yourself?
Well, I think that the media has, it's difficult to generalize. There are obviously good parts of media, but overwhelmingly they found themselves into a business model that required them to behave in a way that was not conducive to help become part of the solution of what we need. They've become shorter term, sensational, often biased in their reporting. It's not anymore the objective judge in many of the countries, at least the main media. So the media itself has become an issue. Obviously a model that is changing drastically with the digitization, but it has certainly polarized the population. It has polarized politics. And I believe that for any company, irrespective of what company you run, so including the media companies, you have to increasingly start to think about how you can become part of a solution, which means how do you actively become part of driving some of these system changes that mm-hmm. we now need in society. And frankly, I cannot mention too many newspapers that would actively right now contribute to that.
Yeah, and is there a difference between traditional and social media in that regard?
Oh, I don't think so. I think in social media there are some that are remarkable as well and have carved out their space. Traditional media, I don't even know if that exists anymore, because that here and now an instant component is now everywhere, which also has driven down the quality. I think you've seen enormous cuts because of this digital transformation that has put pressure on companies financially, mm-hmm. and that has also resulted in a decrease in quality. And then you see the desire. People have now the news often faster than the news media themselves. Everybody is now a reporter with their mobile phone.
Yeah.
So
and you also see it in politics.
It's everywhere.
The leaders there, they're also quoting. Everything is going very fast.
But and it's boiled down to 140 characters, and so we miss that in depth. You know, the real articles on the Sunday New York Times or the Christian Science Monitor or you know, to some extent, or The Economist, there are far or few in between now, to be honest.
And you're a visionary, you're a business leader, we talk about leadership. How would you change it, this system? Because the leadership is also about changing the system. How would you...
So that's a very important question, because I believe in the goodness of people. Rutger Bregman wrote this wonderful book in the Netherlands called Humankind. And it's certainly...
You read it?
Yes. It's certainly worth recommending. And I've probably sold for him hundreds of copies by quoting him quite often. But, you know, I believe in the goodness of human beings, that everybody has a diamond inside of themselves that needs to shine. If you don't believe that, it's probably not worth living. But yet, collectively, we're not behaving in the way we should behave. We're very self-centered. We don't tackle these issues, whilst we know that millions of people lose their lives every day now, nearly as a result of our incompetence to act. And the reason for that is that our behavior is decided by the boundaries that are put around us. And politics has become short-term, business has become shorter-term, so we're dealing with the symptoms and don't attack the underlying causes. And there are only a few. One of the underlying causes that needs to be attacked is our relationship to nature, for example. You know, we cannot have economic growth if we don't find a way to balance our relationship with nature, to regenerate nature. We cannot have unlimited growth if we don't tackle the issue of climate change. Yeah. It's actually preventing
us
from
growing. You are a believer, and me as well, but all the people that still coping with that in their minds or in their business or want to be the diamond but don't know how to do it.
Sure, that's why. Well, I think now, for example, you take climate change, and then I'll come back to one other thing, how we address it, which was your question. But you come back to climate change, 60% of what we need, in fact, all what we need between now and 2030, which is a 50% reduction in emission, can be done with technology that is available today and would be immediately profitable as well. Mm-hmm. So part of it is creating awareness. You know, the International Energy Agency, which isn't the biggest friend of us because it's basically representing the fossil industry, but they're now saying that by all means we can get to 1.5 degrees with a scenario and an investment of 1.5% of GDP, which is far less than what we've done now with COVID, and far less than we have to pay if we don't act to create a healthy economy. The good opportunity that we now have is we need to strengthen our social safety nets, our healthcare systems. We need to create jobs again that we've lost during COVID and make it a more inclusive growth. So governments are going to spend quite a lot of money. We're seeing trillions being pumped in now, the US infrastructure project, the European Green Deal. And it's very important, as we spend so much money, more than we've ever spent before, that we get through to the decision makers in politics, at the G7s, at the G20s, at the summits like the COP26, all of them where we're actively focused on, the Food Systems Change Summit that is there this year, that we ensure that the bulk of that spending is spent in the right way now. And that requires education, that requires helping politicians overcome some of the inherent risks that are associated with that. And what I do, why I created Imagine, is to create a coalition of CEOs that are CEOs of the willing, you might call them, that have that higher moral compass, often leaders in their industries, mm-hmm. that really say, yeah, we should do that, we can do that.
And they speak up together.
And speak up together, just like they speak up in, now in the US against the electoral laws. We're running a campaign that, you know, that taking undermining democracy, to be honest, or speaking up when the issues of LGBT or election frauds were brought up. I mean, more change is now happening because these business leaders speak up than we've ever seen before.
And they collaborate with each other. That's very important.
Absolutely. On those issues, yes. Because, you know, the future of humanity depends on some basic fundamental values, dignity and respect for everybody, equity, compassion. If you don't speak up on those issues, you are undermining democracy. You're undermining the functioning of society. So it's a direct interest for businesses. They can function when societies don't function. But it's also important that they do. 75% of people in their own workforce or in society at large expect these CEOs to speak up. Okay. If you stay silent, you become complicit.
Okay, and to all of our listeners, your a final message to your call to action would be?
Or it depends where you are, but if you are, we are very lucky. We're very lucky in the Netherlands as well. I was very lucky I was born here. Even though I was born just after the Second World War, I had a piece of bar soap at home. So I didn't die of infectious diseases like pneumonia, diarrhea, like 4 million children every year. I also had enough nutritious food. So I didn't suffer from stunting like 160 million children every year. I also had normal food, so I wasn't amongst the 900 million people still that go to bed hungry, not knowing if they wake up the next day. And then I got free education from the Dutch government. My father was working in a factory. Mm-hmm. He had six children. He could have never paid for it. I wouldn't be talking to you if it went for that.
So my message
is very simple. I won the lottery ticket of life by being born in the Netherlands. What did I do for it? Nothing. My simple message is that if you belong to the 3 to 5% of the world population that has won the lottery ticket of life, then I believe it's your duty or your obligation to put yourself to the service of others. Society cannot function if too many people feel they're excluded or not fully participating. Not in the Netherlands, but not globally either. And that also means that we need to take a responsibility beyond our boundaries, borders. Yeah. COVID has shown anything, is that we're all in this together, for heaven's sake.
Okay, so everyone should take their responsibility. Thank you so much for joining me today, Paul Polman. It was so great.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Diana.
Thank you. Alle afleveringen van BNR's Big Five zijn natuurlijk terug te luisteren. Je vindt het in de podcast, in de BNR-app is dat, en op bnr.nl. Maar blijf natuurlijk de hele dag live hier op BNR. Zometeen BNR breekt. Ik wens iedereen een hele fijne.
Ook Harm Edens vind je in de BNR-app.
Je kunt BNR Duurzaam niet alleen live luisteren in de app, maar ook terugluisteren als podcast, zoals al onze podcasts. En naast dat de BNR-app Breaking News meldt, houden we je ook op de hoogte van het laatste zakelijke nieuws.
Download nu de gratis BNR-app en blijf scherp.